In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
How do we talk about America's history of slavery, including enslavement in the Midwest? From SDPB, today is Tuesday, September 23rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we head to the Missouri River in the middle of the night in 1858. We see two Nebraskan sisters fleeing across the river in the dark. Celia Grayson, age 22, and Eliza Grayson, age 20, escaped Stephen F. Knuckles' house and enslavement. Author Gail Blankenaw tracks the sisters' flight to freedom and how it challenges our nation's narrative of slavery, including right here in the Midwest. Plus, author Ann Bossom talks about historical storytelling and distortion. Her book is White Lies: How the South Lost the Civil War, Then Rewrote the History. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 changed existing law. It allowed new states to decide for themselves. Would they enter the Union as a free state or a slave state? The first states it applied to were Kansas and Nebraska. You likely learned about what happened in Kansas in high school history. Bleeding Kansas, John Brown, etc. A new book explores slavery's existence in our direct southern neighbor. Gail Blankenaw is a historian and the author of Journey to Freedom, Uncovering the Grayson Sisters' Escape from Nebraska Territory. The book tells the story of two sisters who escaped their enslaver in southeastern Nebraska, and it explores how what happened in the Midwest fits into our national narrative of enslavement. Take a listen. Can you explain the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the precedent it overturned?
Now there's a start to a question. There have been whole books just about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, but as you know, in this book, I do talk about it because it's very relevant to why this particular escape of these two women resonated so strongly nationwide. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, among many other things, overturned the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The Missouri Compromise was supposed to contain slavery below the 3630 parallel. When they annulled that compromise, it opened up the possibility of enslavement being in places like Kansas Territory, Nebraska Territory, Utah Territory, and New Mexico. So now we had vast expanses of geography that were at least open to the possibility of slavery being incorporated as a part of the labor force in these places.
So how did it specifically impact Nebraska? Because when I was in school, I mainly learned about Bleeding Kansas and that side of that history.
Another one of the surprises of my research was, although Bleeding Kansas attracted a lot of attention because being south of Nebraska, it was considered more likely to be a slave state, but all eyes were on Nebraska as well. In fact, the newspapers show that Nebraska was constantly in the news for the same reasons. There were people bringing enslaved people in here. And in fact, it was almost done more quietly and with less fanfare and in some ways a little bit more accepted, especially in that southeast corner of the state, which is fairly strategically located. People don't realize that we have this little southeast corner that borders Iowa, but it also borders Missouri, a slave state, and then, of course, to the south, it bordered Kansas Territory. There was even, during this territorial period, a time when part of southeast Nebraska tried to become part of Kansas so that they might be able to keep their slaves.
If I ask you, was Nebraska a slave state, what would you say to that?
Well, technically, if we say slave state, no, because we did not become a state until after the Civil War. So we were a state in 1867. However, was slavery ever legal here? I would answer yes. And that is one way that the book challenges the old historical narrative. people assumed, because Nebraska was Union and North, and, you know, there was this idea of magic of geography, mm-hmm. Which I also take on in the book. There is no magic of geography. It won't look like plantation slavery in Georgia, but they came from, this family and this family of enslaved people came from Appalachia, Southwest Virginia, and the majority of white people there were not slaveholders. They were smallholding farmers, the people who did have enslaved people. And slavery can exist in a lot of different forms and in a lot of different climates. So Nebraska was oddly open to having at least a more domestic, small-holding slavery culture as an accepted part of the labor force.
So this book centers on the Grayson sisters. How were they enslaved? Like, where did they fit in on this small-holding farm?
This family was from Southwest Virginia, a place called Grayson County, and I believe that's probably why they were called the Graysons. Mm-hmm. Because they were from Grayson County, Virginia. Their enslaver in Nebraska was Stephen Friel Knuckles, who was very wealthy and well-known in Nebraska history. And his father was Ezra Knuckles of Virginia. They were originally born to enslaved women in Virginia, enslaved by Ezra. And they were given and or sold to Stephen Friel Knuckles, the oldest son, to take west with him when he got married and decided to leave Virginia. So that's how Celia and Eliza were chosen out of a fairly large family to accompany this young man and his new bride to come to Northwest Missouri at the beginning, which, of course, being a slave state, it was legal there. And there was at least one other enslaved person in that household, probably Shaq, because he's such a fixture in the household later, and he is either their brother or half-brother. So the three of them accompanied this young couple to help them actually establish a frontier place in Northwest Missouri. And then as time went on, Mr. Knuckles became very interested in the opening of Kansas and Nebraska, seeing huge opportunities to become even wealthier. And as soon as Nebraska territory opened up for settlement, he and his enslaved people were on the ground in the very earliest days of Nebraska history.
So this to me sounds kind of like the history I'm familiar with as a South Dakotan, where people come out and they homestead. They
exactly.
did it with enslaved people.
Right. Of course, this is before the homestead law, mm-hmm. but you're right. It's frontier living, frontier settlement. And Stephen Friel Knuckles was fairly wealthy, so he was one of the original proprietors of Nebraska City. It is a really beautiful place. I hope you can visit it someday. It's on a hill over the Missouri. Absolutely gorgeous. There's some photographs in the mm-hmm. in the book, and it had a really good steamship dock, which meant, at least at the beginning, they were vying with Omaha to be the next big transportation hub of the Missouri. So he was a very energetic and, I would say, entrepreneurial man, and I have no doubt that they worked very hard, because I think he kept people hopping. His family members and the enslaved family members were all working very hard to establish Nebraska City as a viable place to live.
So what do we know about how the Grayson sisters were treated by the Knuckles while they were enslaved?
We have no real, like, direct evidence. Mm-hmm. So in the book, I talk about they were probably most affected by Lucinda Bourne Knuckles, Stephen Friel Knuckles' wife, mm-hmm. and how she would run the household. But I do have a collection of letters that she wrote back to Virginia that talked a little bit about her day-to-day work, and that they shared in that work is certain. and that they probably did most of the hardest work. Enslaved women were almost always doing things like laundry, which back then was a huge, difficult, hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. And remember, we're talking about frontier times, so they were having to establish gardens, maintain the gardens, and I have no doubt that they did some light field work, but especially they were just available to her for any sort of housework. And the letters reveal that although there was this nuclear family, they didn't really live only with a nuclear family. There were always other people living in the household. So it was a large household that they were helping to maintain. So lots of cooking, cleaning, lots of laundry, lots of serving. I just imagine that the day they left, that when Lucinda Knuckles woke up that morning, she probably thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to do all this work myself.
That's what the whole book is about. Is it's called Journey to Freedom, The Grayson Sisters Run Away. Do you know anything about their motivations for running away?
Again, unfortunately, mm-hmm. there are no interviews for Celia and Eliza, but I think we can discern a lot of it. Number one, no matter whether people were well-treated or relatively well-treated or treated badly, studies show that people just wanted to be free. The most common reason to leave among freedom seekers was maltreatment. But their particular escape was obviously well-planned. This was not done on a whim. So I think that this was something where they lived in Nebraska. They could see the free state of Iowa right across the river every day when they looked down the main street, down to that wharf. Across the river, you could see the bluffs of Iowa. And I think they just called to them. They were on the Underground Railroad, and I'm sure that there were people who said, you know, you probably should be free. It's very ambiguous whether you're free or enslaved. So there was just a lot of controversy roiling around them. Mm-hmm. And I'm certain that they were aware of it, not least because their brother Shaq was working at the local newspaper where people were discussing these issues each and every day. And there were constant pieces about all sorts of territorial history, but including, what are we going to do about slavery?
So what were the sisters risking when they ran away?
They were risking a lot. Number one, the dangers of, I should say a little bit how they crossed.
Yes.
It was November of 1858 when these two sisters crept out of their house in Nebraska City and met a black Cherokee named John Williamson. We don't know exactly where they met, but they met someplace, and they went about 8 miles north to a smaller ferry called Wyoming Station Ferry, which is no longer in existence, but was then. And then he rowed them across with ice running in the river. So it's very cold, a lot of ice chunks dashing against the hull as they crossed this river at night. Now, the Missouri back then was not as controlled a water course as it is today. And it was, even under good conditions, very dangerous to cross. So, you know, you have them in full darkness in the winter in 1858,
wow,
crossing this expanse of river to a place called Civil Bend, Iowa, which was a known place where people with abolitionist sympathies lived. So they did this in the middle of the night. And so there was that danger. Number one, they could have lost their lives crossing the river.
That makes me think of the famous painting of George Washington crossing the river.
Exactly. Exactly. And I don't think they stood up in the boat, though.
they probably played it safe. I don't blame them one bit.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they did not know how to swim. So they go across. Mm-hmm. And but the real thing was, if they were re-enslaved, They probably would have been whipped until they bled, and most probably sold south.
What does being sold south mean?
Down to a plantation in the south where slavery was a little considered more onerous. It was always hanging over any enslaved person who didn't already live in the south that if you don't behave, we'll sell you south. We'll tear you away from your family and we'll sell you south. And so that was one of the fears. When you sought your own freedom, you were considered to be stealing your own labor from the person who was entitled to it. So you were, in fact, called a fugitive slave back then. Now we use the term freedom seeker, which, of course, I do like a lot better because that's what their real motive was. But back then, they were considered fugitives from labor and justice.
They were breaking the law by running away.
They were breaking the law. Kansas-Nebraska Act is super important to this story, but so is the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. That changed the prior fugitive slave laws so that any slave catcher could go into a free state and to chase people. Now, they were doing that already, but a lot of the local authorities would refuse to help them. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 obligated local authorities to assist in capturing enslaved people, and they were no longer allowed any sort of habeas corpus or any sort of legal. There was a whole new legal layer of federal commissioners who would handle everything so that they could avoid all those pesky local people who might not like this practice. And if you aided a fugitive slave, you could be fined and even jailed for several years. So getting caught helping enslaved people was also dangerous.
So the abolitionists who were assisting them and John Williamson, who helped them cross the Missouri, they were all taking a big risk too.
All of them, which makes the story even better, doesn't it? I mean, they really believed in something greater than themselves, all of them. The freedom seekers and those who helped them.
What were the abolitionists kind of getting out of it then? What was the big ideal they were pursuing?
Freedom. Mm-hmm. They felt that the Constitution did guarantee freedom to all human beings, that we were created equal by our Creator, and they were almost all Christians. Mm-hmm. Quakers really led the way, but other denominations also became more and more abolitionist. Others were more anti-slavery, but not all the way to the extreme of abolitionism. Mm-hmm. Abolitionists were considered the extremists because they actually would break the law to help others. Now, when people would ask them, did you know you were helping slaves? They said, well, we didn't ask them any questions. We just, as Christians, when people come to our door, we help them. And that was their answer.
Okay, so Celia and Eliza, they moved into the Underground Railroad. They found quite a bit of support there, but there was also opposition to their efforts. How did Knuckles, their enslaver, react to them running away?
Oh, yes. So one of the reasons they were national news was because their story resonated because of where they were from, Nebraska territory. And people were surprised, just like we are today. Slaves in Nebraska, really? But then there was a secondary story that followed very closely on the heels of their escape. And that was that Knuckles was incensed. And he gathered what he called a search party and crossed over the Missouri, and they went into Civil Bend looking for Celia and Eliza. And when his initial efforts did not bear any fruit, they became a mob. They actually crossed over the river a couple of times. So the second time they came over, it was a mob action. And they did not have a warrant yet. They didn't get a search warrant. They didn't do anything. And they started entering people's houses, beating people up. And they even ended up, there was a free African-American family living in Civil Bend. And they went into their house, tore down their outhouse completely, tore their house apart, took two of the older boys in that family out into the woods and performed a torture and mock lynching to try to get them to say where Celia and Eliza were.
Oh my God.
So this story was a shock that something like this could happen anywhere, but much less in the free state of Iowa. So that hit the national news big, and that part also made the British newspapers, by the way. So wow. This was now becoming an international incident about slavery, slave catching, the violence of pro-slavery people. It just really hit a lot of nerves there. And so when I began this, I just thought I was going to do a final paper for a history class. And when I realized all of this, I realized it had to be, it had a lot of attention then. It merits our attention today, because it was, even the British were looking at this and saying, oh my goodness, what is happening here?
So in what ways does the Grayson sisters story undermine conceptions about slavery?
Well, number one, people said that slavery could not exist in places like Nebraska. And there were actually editors kind of lying. They had to know that there were slaves there. But they were saying, there's no slavery here. Nothing to see here. Well, now you have this very open chasing of women across the state of Iowa with all that well-documented violence. Now you can't say that there weren't slaves there, because there they are. They're being chased. And now it's very visible. So they made the invisible very visible. They also challenged notions of popular sovereignty. When Kansas-Nebraska Act was a controversial law when it was passed, and one of the reasons it was controversial was the slavery question. Stephen Douglas, who of, yes, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, senator from Illinois, proposed popular sovereignty to solve the problem of slavery. He wanted so badly to open up the West to settlement that he was willing to compromise with the South to get it passed. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, let's just let the territories decide. The problem was it was very ambiguous, and Northerners interpreted that popular sovereignty as the territorial legislature could pass laws prohibiting it or allowing it. And once these territories opened, then suddenly the Southerners said, oh, wait, slavery has to be legal until you become a state. Then, only then can you decide. So Celia and Eliza's actual legal status was kind of ambiguous, which was the other part of why so many newspaper editors on both sides of the issue were writing editorials about this incident, because it also touched on, are they really enslaved or are they free, since they were in Nebraska territory for 4 years before they left? Huge debates about that, and it was expected that this question would go to the U.S. Supreme Court. After they left, Stephen Knuckles, he instituted a lawsuit in the Nebraska Territorial Court under the Fugitive Slave Law, and he sued 16 Iowans who were abolitionists for $10,000 to recover the damages of his losses, because they helped Celia and Eliza to escape. Well, it's interesting, because the year before, the Iowans had charged Knuckles with assault and battery, which he had engaged in, and he had been fined by the Iowa courts $10,000. So I think he didn't pick that number out of a hat. He wanted to retaliate and try to get his money back, because under the Fugitive Slave Law, they helped. So that was considered a case that would make it to the Supreme Court, because the whole countersuit that the Iowans lodged was, they weren't slaves. They were free women. We were just helping fellow Christians who showed up at our door. So this was going to be a constitutional question. And the only reason it never made it to the court was because Civil War started in April of 1861. It was still on the dockets in April 61.
It would have come up then, for sure.
It would have. Without the Civil War, it would have reached the Supreme Court. That was probably going to be bundled with a separate suit we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but a separate suit that Nichols lodged in Illinois when we had our second incident where Nichols found Eliza in Chicago and tried to re-enslave her.
Oh, wow. Tell that story.
Yes. So, by the way, most people don't know this, but most freedom seekers failed. They did not get away. They were re-enslaved, and they were not successful in their seeking of freedom. Celia and Eliza, they did not fail. They succeeded, and it was assumed, and probably with not without some cause, that they had made it all the way to Canada, because most of them would go to Canada where they were safe. Well, relatively safe. There are some exceptions to that, too. But they would be much safer up in Canada than anywhere else. Well, they stopped in Chicago. And somehow, there are varying competing stories on how Stephen Nichols found out that they were in Chicago, but they found out that they were in Chicago. So in the wake, right after we find out that Abraham Lincoln has now been elected president, but of course, that was in November, and he would not take office until January. November 1860, Stephen Nichols boards a train and goes to Chicago to recover at least Eliza and maybe Celia. Mm-hmm. He took out a fugitive slave warrant that named both of them, but he knew that Eliza was there, and he did find her. He was able to find a commissioner to help him retrieve her. And long story short, because I don't, you know, it's a good scene, really yeah. good
read
scene.
Read the
book.
Read the book, everybody.
Read the book, because there's a lot more to all of this. But he does try to re-enslave her. He's dragging her into a conveyance in the streets of Chicago, and a mob forms, and the authorities come and arrest both her and him for disturbing the peace. Mm-hmm. And she's put in the armory for safekeeping. And he expects the next morning to go get her and take her to Springfield, where she will be in a hearing, and he'll be able to take her back to Nebraska and do whatever he wants with her after that. So that night, some abolitionist sympathizing lawyers and judges say, hey, we need to move her. And so a deputy sheriff, who was also an abolitionist, is going to move her. And somehow, when he took her out of the armory, he lost her in the crowd and never to be seen again. So she escapes again. And this time I do think she went all the way to Canada, mm-hmm. because clearly Nichols is not going to give up ever. So then he lodged a lawsuit against 9 people in Chicago. So they thought that these 2 lawsuits would also be combined to go to the Supreme Court. And on that one, that's interesting, because even President Buchanan weighed mm-hmm. in, because one of the lawyers involved, his name was Chancellor Jenks. And so he telegraphed the U.S. attorney in Chicago saying, he needs to be relieved of his office right away, not realizing that Chancellor was actually his first name. He thought it was a title. But even the President of the United States was aware of Celia and Eliza and this whole to-do, because Nichols just kept pursuing them and making the news. So even the President of the United States was weighing in on this story. So it wasn't just this little tiny incident that happened just in Nebraska. It was national interest.
So even though it was a story of national interest, you know, it showed up in British newspapers, there is still yep. a whole lot we don't know about the Graysons.
Yes. After this second escape, I think I'm 85% sure it's Eliza up in Windsor, Canada. Her name is Eliza Grayson, and it's spelled wrong, but so what? And any historian who's looked at any censuses knows that they're, even with better documented people, they can be a little bit wishy-washy on mm-hmm. the details. But I do find her. Part of doing good history is teasing out the story, as well as correcting errors. And there were a lot of errors committed mainly by journalists.
Aww.
In the late 19th century. Yeah, sorry about that. But in the, because each journalist would say, hey, this is a good little story. Let's write about it. And they didn't do primary research. They would just look at something that somebody said, and then they would repeat it. And then the next person would just repeat it without looking at it. So, for instance, different dates that this happened, when we can easily document that it was November 1858. We can easily document that the Chicago affair was in November of 1860. But all of a sudden, they left in 1859 and Shaq was with them. Well, Shaq was not with them.
That was the brother or half-brother.
Yes.
Yeah.
And others said all four of them. There was a man named Shade who they said Knuckles owned, but I prove in my book he was never owned by Knuckles, although he was hired to Knuckles, so he was in the household. Mm. But again, just little details like that, that he also was a freedom seeker, and there's no evidence to that at all. So it's constant. I have an Excel file with 80 rows of articles that get something wrong in the story. And I had to put it in an Excel file so that I could keep track of who said what when, to try to figure out how some of the errors even occurred, and to just make sure that they got well corrected. That Excel file helped me to keep my own story straight. And then they would bring in new characters to make it even more interesting. Like John Kagi was killed in Harper's Ferry, and he was a well-known Nebraska abolitionist. And all of a sudden, he was the one rowing them across. Well, he didn't do that. They even said John Brown took them with him once, which is definitely not true. So again, a lot of newspaper accounts wanted it to be even more dramatic by bringing in famous people who didn't actually help them.
So that sounds complicated. What was your writing and research process like? Oh my gosh.
I thought you might ask me.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Well, number one, you do have to just read very closely, and you have to read through things and then read it again and then analyze it. For instance, I was the first person to suggest that Celia and Eliza were sisters, because when you looked at the Knuckles family papers, some Knuckles descendants wrote down who the enslaved people were and what their birth dates were. Some of them are clearly from a Bible, because not only does it have the birth date for Celia and Eliza, but it has the exact time of day, which is more of a Bible thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Eliza was born on this date at 11 o'clock at night. So I'm pretty sure that was copied from a Bible, but I don't have the original Bible. Believe me, I've looked. It may still be out there. If it's out there and somebody's listening to this, please contact me. But I realized that there was a pattern of births about every 2 years for a while. Clearly one woman having children. And Celia and Eliza are 2 years apart. So I suggested they were sisters. And then a later newspaper article in which they were actually asking the Knuckles, after Celia and Eliza left, they said, well, tell us more about this. And they said, oh, these are all people from one family. So that confirmed what I'd already decided after looking at the pattern of births. So it's just getting the details right. Then all of these newspaper articles, I kind of had to lay them side by side in an Excel file and say, this one said this, this one said that. This one all of a sudden, out of almost whole cloth, starts mentioning other people. So it's a lot of analysis, and honestly, it's a lot of fun for some of us. I grew up in an old house in western Nebraska where my great-grandparents had lived, and my grandmother had a master's degree in creative writing, and my mother was a journalism major, and I just grew up with stories and history all around me, and I just loved it from the beginning. So when I go in and I find it like being a detective. And with Black people who are on the margins of society,
mm-hmm.
it's even more of a challenge. And, you know, detectives like a challenge. And so I actually found it fun to figure out what really happened insofar as I could find that, as well as correct the errors that I found, because they merit attention, but they also merit the truth of what happened. And so does John Williamson, who was a Black Cherokee man risking a lot more. I mean, he's not John Brown, an armed white man rampaging through Kansas. He's a man taking personal risks to help his fellow people. And the regular people who took such big risks, we don't need somebody famous to be in there. You know, regular people can make a difference in their corner of the world. And that's not a bad thing to learn either.
In your research, did you ever find anything about an enslaved person in South Dakota Territory?
Yes, actually. Dakota Territory wasn't created till later. And of course, by the time it was created, slavery was not such a big take. But when it was still a territory, partly Minnesota, and then it was actually part of Nebraska Territory, there were enslaved people taken all the way up on steamships. And then close to the Nebraska, it was on the Nebraska side, but close to the border, there was a slave incident up there between Iowans and northeast Nebraska, where there was a little bit of violence involved and a lot of controversy. So yeah, boy, we could go. I do want to talk about... Sometimes people ask me, do you have any other books in mind? And one of them is to talk a little bit more about Celia and Eliza's brother, Shaq, because his life trajectory after they left took quite the dramatic turn as well. But another story is in Dakota Territory, and it's after the time of slavery, but it is a Black woman who ends up shooting a man and he dies later. And so she's tried for manslaughter in the Dakota Territory. It's a fascinating, another dramatic story that I am definitely going to write about, and it will be in Dakota Territory. And also remember forts. A lot of Army officers were from the South, and if you ever had a fort in Dakota Territory, and you did, there were Black people there.
So there's a history here that I think I know almost nothing about.
Yeah.
Wow.
And more can be done on all of this. That's why this is such an exciting area of history, because our area, South Dakota, Nebraska, even Colorado, Montana, we haven't really gotten into all of these stories that are really out there. I actually ran across that woman from Dakota Territory when I was doing another project, and I was just going through old newspapers, and this was before some of the early newspapers weren't digitized, so I was on a microfilm machine, and I saw all these headlines about the shooting, and so I kind of rethought my day's schedule, and this is kind of the workings of a history person. You go, hey, this is a story. So I started printing out all of the stories, because of course you have the shooting and then you have the charges. And it was all in the newspaper, so I just kept printing out all these different articles. And then I did even more research on her, as well as her husband and her children and all sorts of things later on. But the initial thing is just me being in an archive, going along and running across this interesting headline.
And it all starts there. It all starts from that place of curiosity.
Exactly. And you're thinking, well, that's interesting. And then all of a sudden, it becomes bigger and bigger. A lot of serendipity in it, but you have to be there in the archive to be there. As far as other parts of my work, I did set aside at least one day to work on nothing but the book, because otherwise it would never get done. And I probably worked on it every day, but I would recommend having at least in your mind a day that was set aside. That helped me a lot as I went through the writing. And that day might be a research day too, but just make sure that one day a week you have larger chunks of time to really think it through and get in the flow of the writing.
That was author and historian Gail Blankenaugh. Her book is Journey to Freedom, Uncovering the Grayson Sisters' Escape from Nebraska Territory. She will be at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Spearfish this Friday through Sunday. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. History is ultimately a story. And like all stories, much depends on how it's told. Anne Bossom writes history books for readers of all ages. Today we're talking about her book, White Lies: How the South Lost the Civil War, Then Rewrote the History. I want to start with what my experience was like when I was at Lincoln High School in Sioux Falls, and I was in my history class. We were learning about the Civil War. I remember very distinctly that my teacher was in the back of the classroom, and he asked, what was the Civil War fought over? And everyone was talking about different causes, and someone said states' rights, and my teacher just scoffed and said, no, it was about slavery. It was about slavery. He repeated that a couple times. And that was like a very like, oh, okay, so states' rights, like just shove that under a rug. But I understand that you had a very different experience in Virginia in elementary and middle school. Can you tell me about that?
My elementary years began in the 1960s. And schools were just being integrated. We were using textbooks that had been created under the leadership of the state legislature in 1957 in reaction to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling. And of course, I didn't know any of this when I was in fourth grade and reading my history book, which was full of the lies that I write about in my book, White Lies, that were used during that era and the decades before and even since in an effort to bolster the cause of white supremacy.
So let's get into some of those lies. Your book starts with a list of 20 of them. Which of those would you say is the most enduring?
Oh, what a good question. You know, honestly, the one about what caused the war is one. That states' rights answer is one you will continue to hear. And in fact, the U.S. citizenship test that people take if they're applying to become a naturalized citizen, it has 100 civics questions on them. One of them is, what was the cause of the Civil War? And the study guide includes two correct answers. One of them is slavery, the other is states' rights. So this lie is actually still being promoted unwittingly by many of us, but nonetheless is out there and is being used as a way to divert attention from this reality that, in fact, slavery was what provoked the secession and slavery was what provoked the war.
So how does that lie play into what you call the lost cause viewpoint? And what is the lost cause viewpoint?
So the lost cause is a phrase that arose after the Civil War and it became a collection of just thoughts and explanations and rationalizations for what life had been like before the Civil War, what slavery had been like, why the war had been fought, how the motivations of the people who had fought and the nature of their character. And there were various tenets that were part of this lost cause narrative. And they claimed everything from the idea that slavery had been a benevolent institution, where the slave enslavers had taken care of the enslaved in a way that was created a kind environment for everyone. And that was one of the tenets of the lost cause, the one about what caused the war and that the war wasn't fought over slavery, trying to hide that reality from a citizenry that had watched the southern landscape be decimated by war, the southern population also be decimated, its male population greatly reduced, many households lost their breadwinners because of the war. And this narrative helped to shield the elites who had led the region to war in the first place from shouldering all of the blame. And it also allowed them to begin to regain power in the years that followed.
So did the Lost Cause viewpoint spring from these elites? Who was kind of behind this?
Yes. That's how it originated. And there were seeds of it that were planted before the Civil War, because people had been justifying the institution of slavery. People who were enslavers had been justifying that for more than a century using some of the same tenets. And it's not like people sat down and formed a committee and said, we're going to come up with an ideology and we're going to call it the Lost Cause. It just developed organically and came to be associated with this phrase, the Lost Cause, which had been the title of a book that came out shortly after the Civil War and which had glorified the Southern perspective in that war.
So if I found that Lost Cause book and I read it, what are some of the things I would have taken away from it if I didn't know much about the Civil War to begin with?
You would have taken away from it the fact that whites are superior to blacks, that blacks didn't have the ability to be independent people. They needed to be enslaved. They weren't capable of taking care of themselves otherwise, that that they needed to be Christianized, that they had come from a continent that was savage, none of which is true, but those were the sorts of things that would have been in that book, that the Southern generals had been honorable and kind and fair, and they had fought with chivalry, and that the Northern troops and their leaders had been brutal and were brutes. None of that was true either. There were atrocities that were committed by the Southern leaders. There were battles where great carnage took place because of judgments made by both sides.
So it sounds like that book had a whole lot of racist ideas in it, as well as
Correct.
The Lost Cause. What's the relationship between the Lost Cause and white supremacy?
Well, they're integrated.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it doesn't say on the cover of this this ideology, this Lost Cause ideology, this ideology exists to promote white supremacy. But in fact, that is how it was used. And the Lost Cause idea of white supremacy is built on the notion of racism, that whites are superior to blacks, and therefore it's appropriate for them to be in charge, be the ruling class, dominate the society, etc.
So how did these ideas spread through American culture to the point where we still see them today?
Well, that's such a great question, because it's kind of baffling to try to figure that out. And it happened organically, the way so much misinformation is spread. And we see that examples of that in modern times through modern technologies. In the past, we used older technologies. So through books like the Tales of Uncle Remus, which were co-opted from African-American folk tales and turned into tales used to promote this idealized vision of what life had been like in the antebellum years before the Civil War. And so that literature created this reinforcement of the idea that slavery had been a compassionate institution. That's one example. You had cinema begin to get involved with films like The Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind, which were written by Southern authors, just as Uncle Remus was. And in the first case of Birth of a Nation, which came out in 1915, one of the first full-length feature films, was directed by a Southerner who shared the ideology of the Lost Cause with the creator of the story behind the film. And so cinema then projected these notions of Reconstruction having been a disaster, that after the Civil War, when the ruling party from the North, the United States government, was imposing post-war rule on the South and allowed for voting that placed Blacks in powers of leadership in the South, in an effort to undercut that recognition of the fact that this had been a functional society with a combination of Black and white rule in the South. To undercut that, these lies began to develop that there had been great corruption, that there had been mismanagement, and that the Black leadership had been incapable of assuming this responsibility. And so that's portrayed in those films, as are the glorification of the Southern troops and the vilification of the troops from the United States Army, et cetera. And so films, literature, public statues. We haven't talked about all the Confederate commemoration that was put up beginning at the turn of the last century, and not just in the South, but also in the North, recognizing the heroics of the people who had rebelled against the United States government.
So I learned in your book that a lot of these Confederate monuments were put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. Can you talk about who they were?
Sure, who they were and who they are. This group still exists. There are chapters all across the United States. The group is no longer as large and robust as it was at its height in the early decades of the 20th century, when it had more than 100,000 members. But these were the elite white women of their communities, primarily from Southern communities, who had a great deal of influence, who had the free time that was afforded to them by being from wealthy households, and access to funds because of their financial connections through their husbands and so forth, husbands and fathers. And they were united in their loyalty to their ancestors, who had all had some tie to the Confederacy. And they devoted a vast and very well organized effort to commemorate those ancestors, which one could say they had the right to do. And yet what this commemoration did was, again, help to create a physical manifestation in communities throughout the South of the prominence of the Confederacy and respect for the Confederacy, and to put these statues into public squares, in front of courthouses, et cetera, in ways that were sending messages not just that glorified the South, but also that reminded people who weren't from that white elite class, particularly people who were Black living in Jim Crow South at that time, that this was who had mattered, the Confederates who were fighting to keep their ancestors enslaved.
And what about the Confederate flag? We still see that image around quite a bit today. What message did that flag have during this era, and what message does it have today?
So the Confederate battle flag has a fascinating story. And that was, you know, I learned so much while I was researching this book, things that I had not fully understood the backgrounds behind. I had not paid much attention to the United Daughters of the Confederacy. That having grown up in the South, I had been surrounded by these statues and seen that flag flying any number of places. And I did not realize that what we call the Confederate battle flag, that rectangular red and with the crossbars on it, red panel with the crossbars, was actually not a battle flag at all during the Civil War. It's a riff off of a square paneled flag that was used by one segment of the Confederate Army under the leadership of Robert E. Lee. But the rectangular cousin of it sprang to life during this same era when the statues were becoming popularized. It became another symbol of Confederate heritage. It found its way onto state flags, like the flag of Mississippi incorporated into that design. And it existed as just an expression of Confederate heritage, but with this coded undertone that all expressions of Confederate heritage carried in the South at that time, and to some extent in other parts of the country, of a representation of white supremacy. and the flag came out in full force during the civil rights movement as a sign of protest by white Southerners who were against the idea of the resurgence of equality among the races and all people in the South. And it has continued to serve in with that coding, which I think is clear to many people, but it became clear to even more after examples like the 2015 massacre in South Carolina of churchgoers by Dylann Roof, Black churchgoers, when a photograph appeared of him subsequently that he had been taken before the shooting, where he had posed with a gun and the Confederate flag, posting statements about how he was hoping to start a race war.
I remember that image that is like seared into my brain.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. I think that shows how powerful symbols can be.
Symbols and language. I spend a lot of time, and the book is written for teenagers, but I think holds a lot of instruction, historical corrective material and guidance for adults as well, because so much of this has seeped into the zeitgeist and has confused our understanding of our past. And so I talk a lot about how words have had hidden meanings too. One of the ones that's starting to come up again is Anglo-Saxon. And I go into some detail in the book talking about where this expression came from, how it arose. You can help me remember, Ellen, but I believe it was in the late 19th century, kind of building on the idea of social Darwinism and the survival of the fittest, which wasn't Darwin's expression, but it came out of his science. And so there was this notion that in the survival of the fittest, the people who were white, who had this Anglo-Saxon, this British German origin, were the most superior stock. They were the fittest. And so references started getting made to the Anglo-Saxons. And that's not going to mean a whole lot to many people. But if you are following this racially divisive mindset, you know that that's code words for whites, and that that's code words for superiority among whites. And so it's this symbolism and codes through language and art and literature. Even the word truth, which has an air of authority to it, but it can be manipulated to claim, we're only for the truth. Well, the truth is subjective. The truth is something that's determined in a court of law. Facts are different. Facts are black and white in front of you, which you can evaluate and interpret based on your understanding of the facts. And that's another thing that another one of those coded words to watch out for is people who are liberal with the use of the word truth may not necessarily be employing it in the way that we've thought that with the meaning we've thought that word should attain.
I do want to end on a bit of a South Dakota connection. There was a name that kept coming up in your book that I have some familiarity with, Gutzon Borglum. He is known for sculpting Mount Rushmore here. But what role did he play in the Lost Cause?
I couldn't believe this when I came across it. I didn't recognize that connection either. But, he's a very noted sculptor. He's obviously you all have this national landmark in your state. And among the pieces that he worked on before that piece that you could use as a loosely was a car. He was the first person to begin carving at Stone Mountain in Georgia, which some of your listeners will have seen or will recognize as a comparable stone tableau to the scene at Mount Rushmore in terms of size and scale and concept, where you take this this rock face that's suitable for carving and start to put art on it. But in his case, he had been commissioned to put a scene that glorified the Confederacy onto Stone Mountain. And that was an off and on again project that started in 1915, triggered in part by the Birth of a Nation film. It didn't conclude until early 1970, the conclusion of it triggered by the civil push for civil rights in the middle of the last century, and an effort to complete this monument as an example of glorification of the Civil War and what it stood for, including white supremacy. And so he was one of the first sculptors to, or the first sculptor to work on that mountain. They had a falling out with the organizers and ended up moving to the project in South Dakota. But before he'd done that, he'd become a member of the Klan and so forth. And so, you know, he's wrapped up in the lost cause too.
Wow. Yeah, that really surprised me when I read it. We are almost out of time. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you definitely wanted to share with our listeners?
You know, I'll just say how impressed I am with South Dakotans, South Dakota as a landscape, and the book festival. I've been so fortunate to come through the years. It is my favorite festival to attend. I always have remarkable conversations with people, and I can't wait to come. That's how I'd like to end.
That was Anne Bossom. Her book is White Lies, How the South Lost the Civil War, Then Rewrote the History. In the Moment, we'll broadcast live in Rapid City and then in Spearfish at the South Dakota Festival of Books this week. That's Thursday and Friday. Lori will speak with author Elliot Ackerman on Friday evening. They'll discuss the current global disorder and his book, Sheepdogs. And that's our show for today. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.